So for me, the way I viewed it was that, okay, I cannot have this, but I get to have this other thing that I wouldn't have when I was in Zambia. One of the things that I took advantage of when I was an undergrad was the fact that the Wi-Fi or the internet on campus was free. So you could do all these courses that you would want to do, you know, watch all these videos from MIT. You don't even care because the internet is free. When you're in Zambia, you cannot just hop on a video, you know, and start watching the whole course because you are also mindful of the data that you're using. You're paying for that data. So that's you spending money. So all those opportunities, but I guess the whole point is that, of course, as an international student, there are going to be opportunities that you will not have because you're not American, and you should be okay with that. Yeah.
Is Assorted Immigrant Stories podcast. My name is Zenith Mwangahamambamalao, and I am your host. And for those of you that are stopping by for the very first time, this is a podcast about immigrant journeys, the things I and others wish we knew. We have interviews and share conversations with immigrants from diverse backgrounds and countries as they share their own immigration stories. We explore struggles, triumphs, and cultural adjustments. We discuss identity, belonging, and community, and we also highlight successes and contributions to both American society and back home, and that's wherever home might be. We also review some books that touch on the immigrant story. So don't forget to rate and review, like, share, and subscribe to wherever you get your podcast from. Everyone, welcome yet to another episode of Assorted Immigrant Stories podcast. Today I have with me Mr. Joram Muteng. Say hello to our listeners and tell us where you're recording from.
Hello everyone. Yes, this is Joram. I am recording from Davenport, Iowa. So it's in the United States, and that is where I am.
What is the current weather like right now? Because we are dying in the snow here on the East Coast, and we're not used to this up here in Baltimore.
All right. Well, on our end, we are blessed in the sense that we haven't had a lot of snow. However, it is very cold, so you cannot walk outside without a coat on. You need to have some layers, otherwise you will freeze to death.
Wow. So have you always lived in Iowa?
Yes, in my U.S. life, I have lived in Iowa and Illinois. So I am very used to the Midwestern weather, yes.
All very cold places. Interesting. All right. So, Joram Muteng, by the way, I used to think it's Mutenge, but it's not. It's Muteng.
It is not. If I was Bemba, it would have been Mutenge, but it is not. I am Lenje. It is a very small tribe in Zambia. It's not well known. But yes, that is what I am, and that is how they pronounce it.
Okay. So, Joram Muteng wears many hats. He's a data focused and analyst. He is a podcaster, the host of 50 Things You Need to Know About Zambia. He is also a writer, very wonderful stories that he shares, doesn't take long to read. And what else am I missing? What other hat am I missing here?
I sometimes create videos, kind of like a vlog, they call them. Yeah, I do some of that sometimes. But I like to think of myself as a specialized generalist, which means I know a few things about a lot of things. That is how I think of myself.
Okay, that's very interesting. So let's talk a little bit about your podcast and what inspired you to do this, because I know you have said your audience is people outside of Zambia so they can learn about Zambia. But to be honest with you, I think even for every Zambian, Those are such valuable lessons. You know, you do a lot of background work. So what inspired you and what is it about?
Yes, you're so kind to offer those words. But yes, so I like to think of my podcast with my audience as being people outside Zambia. And the reason is that when I came to the US, I was amazed at how very little people knew Zambia. You know, if it is your country and you grew up in that country, you would think everyone else outside that country knows about the country. But I was so surprised. Surprisingly, people know Zimbabwe, which is Zambia's neighbor, but they have never heard of Zambia. You try to tell them about Kaunda, they don't know who that guy is. So I thought, well, if this is the case, let me take it upon myself and create episodes, you know, podcast episode that people can listen to. And I intentionally wanted to make them short so that, you know, if someone is cleaning their dishes or maybe they are just jogging, they could listen to an entire episode and come back and listen more. So the whole idea was, let me share wonderful things about Zambia that other people who don't know about the country could know about it. And then we could have a conversation afterwards.
Wonderful. So 50 things that define Zambia, but I will be the first Zambian to tell you that those lessons are valuable even to a Zambian like me, because a lot of things I didn't know in detail, at least on the surface maybe. And I think you do share that in your podcast. And yes, they're very easy reads, 10 minutes. So I encourage everybody, every Zambian to listen to that podcast, and including obviously the rest of the world, because these are the people we're trying to educate about our country.
Yes.
And to let them know that it exists. So I'll share a short story with you. I am a sucker for sports stories. I love sports stories. And I think that's because I was very athletic as a child.
Okay.
And I grew up in Chilabombe. Part of my life, I was born in Luansha. We moved to Chilabombe. And there is a secondary school in Chilabombe called Mulea Secondary School.
Okay.
And I always wondered, why is there a school with a Tonga name in Chilabombe?
Yes.
And I never asked any adult or anybody, and I wish I did. I just never did, and nobody ever said anything. And I had an uncle go to that school. It is until I listened to your podcast, I was like, oh my God, it all made sense. You know, because today we have obviously Barbara Banda, Rachel Kundinanji, people who've, you know, crossed barriers and they're here in the United States playing soccer. But there was somebody in the 1950s who came to Michigan to run. I think that's such a great story.
It is an
a great sports story. But everything on the podcast, I mean, the Dennis Liwewe, how he started, Kaunda, what led him to become a president.
Of course.
Even Butter the Shoes. I thought he was a Zambia company.
it's interesting when you're doing the research for those episodes, the things that you learn. It's also an educational journey for myself as well, as I do the research for those episodes. So, yeah, it's interesting.
You are on episode 47 and you said 50. So are you going to stop? Because we do not want you to stop.
No. Well, I wanted to make it something that has an end to it. And the reason why I did that was because the format of the entire episode, I actually was inspired by a guy who used to produce a podcast called 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy. And I used to listen to that podcast a lot. And I thought, wow, this is a very wonderful format. You know, there's an end. The listeners know that this thing is going to come to an end. So I tend to dislike things that go on and on until they lose their essence. So I wanted something that was going to have an impact and have an end. Yeah.
I get you. All right. So let's go back to the beginning. We want to find out where Joram was born and raised, what games you like to play when you were a kid, and what family life was like.
Yeah. So I was born in Lusaka, Zambia. And, you know, I usually say that Zambia is divided in three parts. So there's the village life, there's the Komboni life, which is kind of like the townships, and the Mayadi, which is where the rich people would live. Those are the residential areas where you'd find the minister and, you know, the PMs and all that. The interesting thing about living in the townships is that you get the worlds of both sides. So you get the village life partly, and you get the Mayadi life. So it's interesting. You know that you're better than people in the village, but you have an aspiration. You know, you want to be one of the people living in the Mayadi. So I kind of loved that. Otherwise, living in Zambia growing up, it was a wonderful life. I didn't grow up wanting a lot of things, because what I had was enough. So we would play around, you know, playing soccer and pool table, not the actual pool table that you would find in a bar or something, but we would actually make our own. So you would get a board and get some cushions. So I don't know if you know, I don't know how, the flip-flops, you know, the thing that stays on the, that protects your soul on the flip-flops. Those are the things that we would cut out and put on the board to use as cushions for the pool table. And we use marbles as the balls. So it was an interesting childhood. Otherwise, yeah, everything was fine. I enjoyed playing on the ground, you know, beating these made up soccer balls that you would make with plastic bags. So it was an interesting life.
Wow, that's very interesting and sounds like a lot of creativity there where you were growing up. You know, people don't have, but they make things that look like, you know, what will be used in the real games, and kids have fun because there's a lot of kids to play with, right? But it's interesting what you're saying about the three levels. You say village and then Kombon and then Mayadi, right?
Yes.
Because I consider myself having grown up in Mayadi, but we were not rich though.
Oh. How on earth did you find yourself in Mayadi if you were not rich?
No, we were, we were what I think is considered middle class and maybe with a degree of privilege.
Okay.
But not rich. Yeah. Yes. Because even like at our level, right? There was the people you looked up to and said,
Yeah.
Now those are rich.
Yeah, it's an interesting setup. It's an interesting setup.
But, you know, obviously when I look back, I do recognize the privilege that I probably didn't recognize then. You know, the schools we went to, and a lot of privilege, but middle class.
Okay, good, yeah.
Middle class, that's very interesting. And when I go back home, I prefer to go to the village than to stay with my aunt in the Kombon. I like the space in the village.
right.
Than the crampiness in the Kombon. It is I can do like 10 days in the Kombon.
Okay.
But after 10 days, I'm like,
That is the life that I grew up in. I am very used to that life.
I'm like, I need to get back to the city. I need to go to a hotel. But I can hang. I can hang in there. It's not like I can't hang in there. I can, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I can. Okay. All right. So, and so I guess you'd eat wild fruits like the rest of us and.
Yeah. Yeah. We would eat a lot of wild fruits. But the one I particularly liked was, I don't even know how they call it in English, but it is. What was the local name? It's kind of like small, but it had, I think, six kind of lines where it was kind of cut a little bit, and you would have, what was that?
The chewy stuff.
Yeah, the chewy stuff, but you don't swallow it, so you chew it and suck out the sweetness out of it, and then you spit it out.
Oh, what are they called?
I don't know the English name.
But we used to call it amamina yabakote.
No? Yes, we used to call them that. They were so sweet. My God. But It's a weird name. A lot of people would be put off by that name, but trust me, that fruit is so good. It is. I used to love that. I used to love that. Yeah. Otherwise, I learned when I left Zambia that mangoes were a delicacy. You know, like people would, you know, salivate over mangoes. But I for me, mangoes were not my thing because they were so common, and I was like, I don't like mangoes, so I don't, you know, I don't crave them as much as people do because I was just tired of mangoes. They were just everywhere. Yeah.
I mean, they were very common. But it is my favorite fruit, though.
Oh, really?
Still
Wow.
is my favorite fruit.
Ah, that is interesting. Yeah, if I were to pick a favorite, even to date, I think it would be a banana.
Oh,
Bananas are good for me. Yeah, I love bananas. Wow.
okay, and before we proceed, I forgot to ask you, how do we say hello in Lenje?
It depends. So if I feel like the generic hello is not there, but it depends what time of the day. If it's in the morning, you would say Mwabuka, which means good morning. If it's in the evening, you would say Kwashiamiani, which means how is the evening going? So it depends on what time of the day. You wouldn't just say hello out of nowhere.
Okay, so
Yeah.
Lenje, there's a I'm hearing a bit of Tonga in there, right?
Yes, it sounds, because I can understand Tonga to some extent. I think I can understand like maybe 90% of Tonga, but a few words would pass me by. Otherwise, it sounds like Tonga, but it is a different type. Yeah, it's a people who hear it say, "Well, what type of Tonga is this?" It sounds weird, but it's actually not Tonga. Yeah.
Because what you said, same thing in good morning would say mwabugabuti, which is like, you know, kind of like how have you woken up, but it's you mean good morning.
Yes.
And in the evening you'd say the same thing, wasiabuti.
Ah, yeah, right.
Very
Yeah.
similar. Yeah, very, very similar. Okay, so tell me, when was the idea of coming to the United States first come to you?
Right. So when I was, I think, 8th grade, I started watching MTV because my friend had DSTV. So every once in a while, when I visit him, we would watch these American music videos. And I thought, wow, that is quite a wonderful place. I wonder if one day I could end up in America. But that was kind of like just admiring as a little kid. But afterwards, when I was kind of like maybe 10th grade, I started becoming serious about the idea of going abroad. So I wanted to leave Zambia. I thought Zambia was a good place to live in, but it seemed too small for my dreams. I thought I could make the best of myself outside Zambia. I just thought Zambia didn't have much to offer me at the time. Maybe it does now, but I just thought this is not the place for my dreams. So the idea was just to leave Zambia, not necessarily to come to the US, although I knew that I wanted to end up in the US at some point, but the path wasn't clear enough. So that is why I started, when I left Zambia, I started off by going to the UK first to do part of my high school there. And then when I lived in the UK, I just thought, this country is not for me either. Let me leave this country and go to the US. So when it was time to choose colleges in the UK, my friends were choosing British colleges. I said, no, I am not going to a British school. I want to go to an American college. That is how I ended up in America. Otherwise, the idea was to eventually end up in America, but the path was kind of long-winded. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm just going to ask a few details. So tell me how you're coming from the township to going to the UK. What steps were made? What visa was it? Was it a scholarship?
Yeah. So I would actually take you a little bit back. So when I was in primary school, I went to a school in the Ikombon. So it was kind of like that is the world you knew. So no dreams, no whatever. But the good thing was that I had gotten very good marks on my grade 7 exam. And I remember choosing, because you had to select a school where you want to go and do your secondary school, which is grade 8, grade 9. And I remember picking a school called Lotus Basic School, because I picked that school because all of my friends had picked that school from my school, from my primary school. So I wanted to meet my friends again so that we could, you know, continue playing. But my results were so good. And when I came back to get my results, I saw that the acceptance letter was for a different school, the one that I had not chosen. And that school turned out to be Matera Boys. Now, for people who live in Lusaka, they know that Matera Boys is a very special school. People who get very good marks end up there. And somebody actually described Matera Boys in a very good way. They said, Matera Boys is a special school because the rich people's kids want to go there and the poor people's kids who are smart want to go there. So I found myself there. And when I arrived, it was like a veil was lifted out of my face and I could see the world in an entirely new light. People had bigger dreams. And I remember thinking, man, I feel like I've been living under a rock. What was I thinking about? You know, my dreams were so short-sighted and so small, but now these kids are doing all these wonderful things. And just my world just changed out of that. And that is when all these desires of going abroad started, you know, populating my head. And that was the ambition that I had. So I credit Matera Boys just for giving me a new world view to see the world.
Wonderful. And for context, for those that are listening here in the United States, when he says Kombono Township, it's kind of like the ghetto, like you're in the ghetto.
Yes, and it's yes. Like, I think that is the equivalent, yeah.
Okay.
So from there now, I got a scholarship to go and do part of my high school in the UK. And that scholarship was called the UWC Scholarship. I think it is the initial stand for United World Colleges. So that one is very interesting too, because they have what they call national committees that they set up in these countries. So I think each country has a national committee. So you have to go through the national committee, and then the national committee submits your papers to the various schools that form part of this UWC. I think at the time when I was applying, there were 13 schools. One was in the UK where I went. Another one where I had chosen to go was in Canada. Then there's one in the US as well. Then a few in Italy and Hong Kong, I think, and a few other places. So they're all over the world. But it depends which one wants you, really. So I wanted to go to Canada initially, but I was picked in the UK one, which I actually, in retrospect, I really appreciate. I'm glad I ended up in the UK.
Oh, that is wonderful. So where can someone go to find these applications?
Right. So the National Committee, they have a website, but it is not, I feel like it is not well known. It is not well known. I learned about it from a friend who I was with at Matera Boys. So he's the one who communicated with me and we applied together. So he actually got the scholarship as well. He ended up in Italy. But it's not very well known, but they have the national committee, they have a page. So they have a website. So anyone, any Zambian, not anyone, but any Zambian who is interested could apply. All you have to have is good grades, I think, because that is the filtering factor that, you know, eliminates a lot of people. They really require you to have very good grades. So if you have those, then you can go ahead and apply. It is very, very competitive. And they pick only a few people. In my intake, they only picked, I think, 3 people out of the whole Zambia. So that's a little, I don't know, maybe nowadays they pick a lot more people, but in my intake, they only picked 3. So I was very lucky. I wouldn't say that I was the smartest out of everyone in Zambia. I think it was just pure luck.
You should give yourself credit.
Wow.
There's a reason you were picked. You worked hard. Look, you got your grades, grade 7. You went to Matera already. It was because you did so well. So I think credit to you. You were not lucky. You deserved it.
Thank you. Well, I guess I will take that.
Yeah, you deserved it. Okay. So when we're done, when you get a chance, maybe send me the website. That way we can put it in the show notes, you know, for people to see, so that people can share. And maybe somebody somewhere may not know about this and they might take the chance, and maybe that might be their path. So you get to the UK. How many years of high school did you do there?
I did 2 years. 2 years of high school in the UK. It was a very interesting experience in the sense that I had never left Zambia my whole life. It was the first time. And to be honest, I had never left Lusaka. I grew up in Lusaka, spent my whole kind of childhood until middle teens in Lusaka. And the first time to leave Lusaka was actually when I was leaving Zambia. So it was an interesting experience. Cultural shocks. I don't know. It was. I don't know if you want me to talk about that, but yeah. So I think the first thing that I was surprised by was the fact that you could pick up a newspaper for free. I was so surprised because when I was growing up, my uncle would send me to go and buy the newspaper. So I thought newspapers were supposed to be paid for. But when I landed in London, I was surprised. People were just picking up newspapers in the airport. I was like, where are they paying? Is this free? And somebody said, yes, of course it is free. And I remember thinking, yes, this is a whole new world. I could read as much as I want. But it was so wonderful. And the other thing was the fact that there was free internet. You know, you could walk into a McDonald's and just use the internet for free. I was like, wow, this is insane. We had to pay for internet, but now I could use it for free. So all those things. And but in terms of the way people live, though, I was surprised by the fact that you could talk back to your mother or father. You know, like the kids that I used to school with, they would talk back to their elders. And I thought, that is so strange. When I was growing up in Zambia, you cannot talk back to your elder. You have to listen and only listen. But these kids would, you know, talk back and challenge their elders. It was a whole new world. I was surprised.
How often were you able to go back home?
I used to go back home once every year. In the summer.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So you finish high school. So how do you then pivot to come to America? What do you apply for? Is it college?
Yes.
What visa are you getting? How does that work out?
Good. Yeah. So as the school I was at was also a special school, kind of international school. So representatives from American colleges would visit the school and try to, you know, recruit students. So I never made one of these trips that people make, especially the US kids, where you would actually visit a college to see if it is a suitable college for you. I never made those trips. I just spoke to the representatives. And so just learning a few things about American colleges and applying, and you know, you get accepted. So the visa I was on was the F1 visa, which is, I think, the visa that every student who comes to the US gets. So that is the visa I was on. Otherwise, I just applied and you know, got picked in one or two colleges and weighed the advantages and decided to go where I ended up going. But yeah.
So did you go straight to a 4-year college?
Yes, I did go straight to a 4-year college.
And how did you pay for that?
How did I pay for that? I was on a scholarship. So for my undergrad, I was on a scholarship.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Wonderful.
Postgrad, I had to pay for myself. It turns out that very few universities would pay for your master's degree unless you are doing a PhD. But I didn't have the patience to do the PhD. So I wanted to check out after master's.
No, but that's, you know, that's wonderful that you had a full scholarship, you know, under F1 undergrad, because that's where it can be hard for a lot of people.
Yes, yes. And undergrad is more expensive than... I had to do what they call work study jobs, because you need money for upkeep too. So maybe the scholarship would pay for your tuition and a few other things, but for upkeep, maybe you would have to work.
All right.
Yeah.
So As a student, you have your scholarship. What other issues did you see that other international students might face, even though on a full scholarship?
Yeah, so I feel like international students, they are limited in what they can do. The US is a very special place in that it gives you a lot of opportunities, but those opportunities are not equal to everyone. You realize this when you arrive that, oh, I cannot do this. I remember thinking I could work outside campus, but you cannot do that if you're on an F1 visa. You're only limited to do campus work. And the trick is that campus work doesn't pay as much. So you might be doing the same type of work on campus and someone is doing another that same type of work outside campus and they're getting paid a lot more than you. But they can do it because they are American and you cannot do it because you are not American. So just the realization that certain opportunities might pass you by can be off-putting to a lot of people. You know, they think, oh, maybe we're being mistreated or they're taking advantage of our labor and paying us low. But then again, you have to also think about some of the opportunities you are getting out of the country. So for me, the way I viewed it was that, okay, I cannot have this, but I get to have this other thing that I wouldn't have when I was in Zambia. One of the things that I took advantage of when I was an undergrad was the fact that the Wi-Fi or the internet on campus was free. So you could do all these courses that you would want to do, you know, watch all these videos from MIT. You don't even care because the internet is free. When you're in Zambia, you cannot just hop on a video, you know, and start watching the whole course because you are also mindful of the data that you're using. You're paying for that data. So that's you spending money. So all those opportunities. But I guess the whole point is that, of course, as an international student, there are going to be opportunities that you will not have because you're not American and you should be okay with that.
And did you find community there? What did community look like for you?
So one of the things that a lot of international students talked about was the fact that they thought Americans were superficial. And not that, this is not to kind of like talk down on Americans or anything, but just the whole idea that someone would say hello to you and then not even care what your response is. So it was a whole new perspective where someone would just pass you by and say hello, and depending on how you answer, they are not even interested. They were just saying that for the sake of saying it, or maybe they didn't want to keep quiet. So I don't know. To me, I saw that and I was like, oh, maybe this is the culture that people live in and you learn to adapt. But it was also surprising to me that, you know, people would want to talk to you and then not care about your response. They were just doing it to be nice.
What about things like healthcare, mental health check on the full scholarship? Did they take care of that as well?
You could go to your what is known as an RA, or if you have some issues, to talk to them. And if the RA can't handle that, they would maybe refer you to another school official. So there were those services. But I feel like maybe I was lucky enough to not have those problems. But I think the people who had those problems, they had other people to help them out. So it wasn't just that they are leaving you alone to fend for yourself. You had other people also to help you out.
Right, right. I agree. Most schools do have services. We just, for example, I just didn't know about them because you're so focused on how am I going to pay? How am I going to eat the next semester? Where am I going to work? Because even these jobs on campus, you're fighting for them with everybody else. It's not just you.
Yes, yes.
It's you and all the Americans. But it was later I realized, oh, they have services. They even have a writing center. If you're not writing well, you can go to the writing center.
Yes, we had that too. Yeah, so you could write your paper, and if you wanted it to have some improvements, you could go to a writing center and they help you out. Yeah.
So you just have to ask, seek out the services, and you'd be good. But yeah. For example, I didn't know that. All those things are things I found out later. I was like, oh, I could have gone. I could have asked.
The advice I would have for someone who is, you know, just arriving in the US as an undergrad is look out for the resources that your school has. You might be oblivious to them. You might not know that they exist. But if you take an active role in looking for those resources, you would be amazed at how much the college can offer you.
Right. Okay. And what was your experience like in general when you now went for your postgrad?
It was good. I think it was good. So one of the things I love about the American education is that it is not too exam focused. By that, I mean that the exam is not the be all and end all. So you cannot do extremely well on the exam, but that doesn't matter as much because the stuff that you've been doing, the assignments that you were doing, the papers that you were writing, all those add up to what your grade is going to be. So that is the approach that I like. Whereas in Zambia or the UK, the exam is really the determining factor. You really have to do well on the exam. So to me, I think that promotes memorization, which is, I think, not that valuable anymore in the world that we live in. I don't need to remember what the formula for, gravity is, because you can just look it up. You can just look it up if you need to use it. So you don't have to remember that type of stuff. You need to free up your memory to think about creative ideas, ideas that are going to help you to develop or maybe create things that other people are going to use, as opposed to memorizing the stuff that someone discovered, because Google is there. All you have to do, go on Google. What is the formula for gravity? Here it is. Let me use it. Yeah. So I like that approach. That is why I was adamant that I wanted to remain in the US for my higher education. And graduate school was also just the same. You know, it was a lot less memorization and a lot more project-based learning.
I absolutely agree. A lot of, critical thinking.
Yes.
A lot of practicals going to the actual places, you know, either via internships or via clinicals to practice. Mm-hmm. Because it's true. I remember when I first came here, people would joke and say, munaenda kuma ABC, bachta, multiple choice. But I'm like, I love it, you know, because it explores so many other things. You're doing a project here, you're doing a paper,
yes.
And then, okay, you do content as well. But like you said, content might only be 30% of the grade anyway. So,
yeah,
the whole mastering of stuff, like, okay, what does that do? What does that do for me?
It doesn't help you out.
Yeah, in the world today and in the world where we're going, we need to think critically outside of the box be with the times. I mean, they'll even let you redo an exam here.
yes. It is because they understand that learning is not just about the exam. It is about the stuff that you use that knowledge to actually create. That is why most people get surprised that how come the US develops a lot of technologies. That is because they are so focused on developing stuff as opposed to being the smart kid who knows every single thing there is to know. That is not helpful.
Right.
What are you doing with that knowledge now that you have learned? What are you producing out of that knowledge? That is the challenge that I would give to a lot of countries that favor a lot of memorization type of learning. It's like, why are you misusing the brains of the people in your country? Why don't you encourage them to actually create from that knowledge? Yeah.
I always say things should change. The whole memorization stuff, I'm just like, yeah, why am I doing 10 subjects and I have to memorize?
Right. That is just a waste of time.
What a waste of time. Yeah, what a waste of time, because you come here and you realize, scratch that. We're starting afresh.
Yeah.
That didn't even matter. Yeah. We're starting afresh. Okay, well, we'll start winding down. So just give us, in summary, what you'd advise a young Joram who is thinking about coming to America. What would you advise them, or any young person anywhere in the world thinking about coming to the United States?
So if you are thinking about coming to the US, I would say, by all means, come here. There's a lot of opportunities. I know there's a lot of bad things being said about the US, but trust me, if you come from a poor country and you land here, you'll be amazed at how many opportunities are right in front of you. So for me, I acknowledge that the US is not perfect in every sense. You know, there are certain aspects that are not good, but my God, is it better than where I came from? So I would say, if you know that where you're coming from, you don't have a lot of opportunities and you land here, there's a lot more opportunities. And my challenge to you is that, will you take advantage of those opportunities? So for people who are coming, make sure that you use every single opportunity that comes your way here. Because one thing I love about the US, again, is that they don't really care which family you come from. In other words, all these things like, this guy grew up in the ghetto or whatever, if you just know the stuff, if people realize that you provide value to them, they are going to give you the benefit of the doubt and allow you to grow in your career or as a student or as anything, really. So the sky is the limit, really, here. I would say, just come here, take advantage of every opportunity, because really the sky is the limit. And I am a living example here. I grew up in what would be called a ghetto in Zambia, you know, in the Kombo, and now I'm here. A lot of people get surprised, my friends from back home, how on earth did this guy end up in the US? But, you know, just work hard. And so here's the mistake that most people make. Most people want to wait for the opportunity to come their way, and then that's when they want to start preparing. But I would say, even when the opportunity has not arrived, start preparing. So if it means learning about the stuff that you want to know a lot more about, getting yourself ready for whatever chance that would show up that you're going to leave the country that you're in. Because when you do that beforehand, it makes it easier for the opportunity, when the opportunity comes, to actually take advantage of it. When you're waiting for the opportunity to come and then start preparing, that is too late.
Very wonderful insights there. So tell us, what are you doing to give back to either here, your community, or in Zambia?
Right. So on my website, I write a lot. And I think I would say maybe 75% of my writing is actually targeting Zambians. So there I give advice. And it's interesting, because when you've been there, done that, you have a whole new perspective. This is kind of like me, the lessons that I wished I would have had before I knew the stuff that I know now. So I picture myself as a kid in Zambia growing up in the Kombon and thinking about the pieces that I write as something that could be advice for that young person. Like, what is the world like? The last post I wrote it was titled, "Do They Know They're Competing With Everyone in the World?" And I love that, because most people growing up in Zambia or maybe Kenya or any of these what would be called third world countries, they would think that just by being the best in their area, maybe at their school or whatever, is enough. But that is no longer enough, because the world has changed. The whole world now is a global village, which means that being the best in your class is no longer enough, because if you want a job abroad, you want a job in the US, you're not competing with the people in the US, you're competing with everyone else, because they all want that job. They know that the US pays well, or it could be in England or whatever. So if you really want to get the most out of this world, you have to see your competition as the whole world. So if I was growing up in Zambia, I wouldn't have known that. But now that I have moved around, I am trying to spread that knowledge now to anyone who is living in the village, the Kombon or whatever, could see, oh yeah, if this guy is a Zambian and he's saying this, which means he knows a few things that I don't know and I should listen.
Wow, Very powerful there. And you know, something I forgot to ask you, there's a point you were talking about when you moved to the UK and it was your first time living Zambia. And in that moment, I was thinking about a question that Kola asked me in the episode that's actually going to go up tonight. And he asked about us as Zambians enjoying like the natural resources, the Victoria Falls, and and you know, you said it was your first time, and I wanted to get your perspective as somebody who was growing up in the Congo. And like, do you even know, like, oh, there are these, you know, national parks you can go to? Like, what's the access like?
Yeah, that is interesting. It's not really there. The people I was playing with in my neighborhood, they don't even know where the Lusaka Museum is. They've never been there. They know about it. Maybe they've heard about it, but they've never been there. So all these kind of like Victoria Falls, they wouldn't have had a chance to go to these places like the national parks or maybe visit the Lusaka Museum, because that is just out of their reach. The perspective is that, at least in the neighborhood I grew up in, was that those things are for tourists. You know, they're the ones who can afford to see those things. So Zambians are kind of, they distance themselves from those things. Not intentionally, but there's just that perception that those things are too expensive for me to spend money on and you know, enjoy myself. So I have never been to the Victoria Falls myself, and I have never been in the Lusaka Museum. I remember driving past it, but I have never been inside, which is a shame. But yeah, so those things, I did not see them myself, and I wish that when I go back to Zambia, I would have a chance to actually see the natural resources that Zambia has to offer.
Even though things are changing now and they're trying to make like local rates, but they're still kind of high.
Yeah.
But there's also the issue of not really appreciating what's in your background type of thing. Mm. Like, okay, it's there, but it's just there. Because even for me,
yes,
all these things I started appreciating as an outsider, like after stepping outside, actually, I was like, oh my God, I want to go back and I want to go to Mansa and I want to go to, you know, I want to drive across the Limpopo River. Like, you know, all these are things you just don't think about before. Now, I will say for us, when I was growing up, when we got to grade 6, every child would go to the national park for a week. Mm-hmm. And I remember we went to like Kafuala Camp, which is in Kafue National Park. Other people went to Ngoma Lodge. I know when it was my brother's turn, they went to Livingstone. So we did have this opportunity somehow. But even then, after once that was done, it was like, okay, you know, it was sort of behind you. And it's now you look back and you're like, man, there's so many beautiful places to go and see. But it's one of those things that happens after you step outside. Yeah. But even the cost, I think it needs to reduce more.
Right. Yeah. It might be, the cost might be okay for the tourists because they are coming with a foreign currency. But I think for the Zambians, it's too pricey. You know,
So it needs to be a way to, I don't know, lower those numbers for the locals. So, and let the children see, let the people enjoy what we have.
Yeah, because it's really, it's very important for young kids to appreciate what their country has to offer. Yeah.
So tell us, what do you like to do for fun?
What do I do for fun? I like to watch movies, TV shows specifically. I think most of my life is kind of on the serious end. So that is my way to wind down, watch a TV show or a movie.
Oh, that's really interesting. And speaking of that, you did do an episode on Kabanana.
And because I did.
It was one of the first TV shows that was written in Zambian, I guess produced by a Zambian. And I remember I used to watch it too. It really was a fresh of breath air because we used to watch telenovelas just like you.
Yes.
In the episode, you did mention a popular telenovela. For us, it was No One But You.
Ah, I remember my mother used to like No One But You, but I was too young for that.
Yes, yeah. That's what we watched. I mean, it was like every Fridays or every Wednesdays, and it felt like they were only giving us 18-minute segments per week. Yeah, it's very interesting. All right, so tell us, since you love watching movies and shows, what was the last Zambian show or movie or series that you watch, and where did you watch it from?
I think I the problem with Zambian shows or movies is that they are rare to find, especially when you're outside Zambia. So I think the last one I watched, I was in Zambia, but that is a while back. It was Flat 6. It used to be a TV show on Movie TV, Flat 6. It wasn't very popular compared to other shows like Banja or, the one that is kind of hot right now. But Flat 6 was interesting to me because it was about university students. And that was the time when I was thinking about university. So I loved that, kind of picturing myself in that life in a few years. That was the appeal to me in Flat 6.
Oh, wow. I wish I could find that. You are absolutely right. It's very difficult to find Zambian content to watch. For a while, there was a series we were able to watch on YouTube. And what I'm speaking of is probably 8 to 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was highlighting the AIDS pandemic issue. I've actually just forgotten the title of the series. It was good.
There are a couple on Netflix. I think one is titled Can They See Us? It is the story about John Chitty and albinism. Can They See Us? Am I saying the right thing? I think that's what it is. And there's another one. I've watched it with my son. It's kind of like, you know, techie, cartoonish. And I think it's called Mama K's Team 4 or Super Team 4. I have forgotten. It has been a while. I believe there's something on Amazon Prime. I will look for it. I'm told it's about animals. I haven't checked it out yet, but I also do believe there's a movie coming on Amazon Prime from Zambia. So, you know, there's a few that have been out there. And I hear of Umpali and Zuba.
Oh, yes, shows. I have heard of those. Yeah, I haven't seen any of those.
Now, yes. You love to write. I love reading your writing. How did you become like this writer?
So one of the things I noticed about myself is that when I am trying to think about a concept, it is very hard for me to have my own viewpoint on that concept. You know, it's very easy to hear all these viewpoints from other people and then assimilate them in your head, thinking they're your own viewpoints. But when you sit down to write something down, it kind of gives you a chance to step back and say, what do I think about this? Like, let me use my own thoughts. So that exercise for me was very interesting. Every time I sat down to write something, I was infusing my own thoughts into an idea. And I thought, well, this is a good way to train your mind. So that is why I started writing. And every time I write about something, you know, some people might disagree with me, but that is okay because I am infusing my own viewpoint. A lot of people are becoming intellectually lazy in the sense that they're just hearing all this stuff coming into their heads and then they take it on face value without really thinking about it. And that is the danger of the modern world. Too much information, but very few time to process that information and think about what is your take on that information. So writing is a refuge for me to actually apply my mind on this, on those concepts.
Oh, that's wonderful, because I am a bad writer. But I have a lot to say, and I'm always afraid that when I put it on paper, the writing is going to be bad, but the ideas are there.
Yeah, I think the writing can be improved the more you write. So it is like trying to ride a bicycle for the first time. Of course, you're going to fall down, but as you continue to ride it, you become an expert at it. So I think writing is like that. It's like a muscle that you train every time you write something. And I think most people ask me, how do you know that this is good writing? You kind of develop a sense for it. So the more you write and the more you read other people's writings, the more you have that kind of sense. It's like a poetry where a poet wouldn't tell you what is good poetry, but just by listening to that poem, you can tell, oh, this is good writing. So that is the way I see writing. So I think on your problem that you're not a good writer, just continue writing. And out of that bad writing, good writing will emerge.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me, what was the last book you read written by a Zambian? And what book written by a Zambian would you recommend to us?
Okay. So the last novel I read written by a Zambian, again, was a while back. You know, it's very hard to find these resources once you leave Zambia. But it was a novel called Quills of Desire. It was written by Binwell Sinyangwe, I think. It's been quite some time, but I think that is the name. I loved that book because it kind of chronicles the life of this young man who is trying to apply himself through education so that he can leave Zambia and go abroad to study abroad. I think he was kind of following the footsteps of his older brother. But just that kind of act that you can try to apply yourself and then change the course of your life was very appealing to me. And when I was reading it the first time, I didn't think it was written by a Zambian. But after a few, because the writing was so good, but after a few pages, I noticed that he was talking about some of the areas that I knew in Lusaka, like on that bus station or on that one. So that relatability was very good to me. Like, here am I reading in a book about places that I've actually been there to. Like, he's talking about a bus station that I know for sure. It felt a little too close to home, and the material was interesting. So that is the last kind of novel that I read written by a Zambian. But in terms of other books, I would recommend the autobiography of Kenneth Kaunda. It is very, very interesting. Like, a lot of people think they know a lot about Kaunda, but actually they don't know a lot, because the stuff that they know is probably just something they heard or something that, you know, their parents told them. But if you read that book, you understand what type of a man he was, and you try to appreciate him even more. So the autobiography of Kenneth Kaunda, I highly recommend.
Oh, thank you very much. I will look for that, because I myself, in the last maybe 2 years, have been on the hunt for books written by Zambians. I actually have quite a collection.
You've got, yeah. I actually wanted to ask you about that, because if you're willing to share some of those, because I don't know where you get them. Oh, I love your collection.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. But I buy most of those on Amazon.
Oh, really?
80% okay. of all the books, including the one I bought last year about street kids.
Yeah.
Actually, all of them I bought from Amazon.
Interesting.
Maybe with the exception of one or two, but all the books that I have that I shared in our creative group, I think I bought on Amazon, but I will look.
Yeah.
The Lion's Den, that was just gifted to me. The author, I think Iris Mwanza, came to Washington, D.C. to do a book signing.
Okay.
And you recommended one to me, I think, by...
Yes. By, what's her name? Yeah, Mling. Yeah. Yes. It's a... I haven't read it myself.
Novel or something.
Yeah,
like
yes. I haven't read it myself, but I attended kind of like a Twitter space where she was talking about the book and people were asking questions. And I thought it was really interesting as I listened to her talk about the book and answer people's questions.
Okay.
And I thought, well, I need to get my hands on this book.
Yeah, no, they're wonderful.
Yeah.
The Pharaohs by Namwali Sarpeil. That one I saw on Obama's list.
Ah, right. She's a very, very good writer. She won the Arthur C. Clark Award for science fiction. I was surprised when the first time I read about her, I was like, which Zambian is this? Man, she's winning this highly acclaimed prize. I was so impressed. When I read the Binwell Sinyangwe novel, you know, like talking about the places that you're familiar with, I remember thinking to myself, oh, so this is how Americans or British people feel when they're reading a book written by their fellow country person. You know, they know the places that this person is talking about. And I thought, man, how nice would it be that if everything that I am reading, I can actually visualize these places and see them, as opposed to, you know, reading about the US and you've never been there. It's a little too distant. So that feeling, I feel like it's you can't set a price on it. It's so good to read about the stuff that you are familiar with.
Yes.
Yeah.
Even for my podcast, I always say Americana, the book Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. I always say, okay, I was already having thoughts of doing this. But when I read Americana, I was like, oh my God, these experiences are in a book. But to your point, it's not only that they were in a book. They were about places I also knew. She's writing about Philadelphia.
Yes.
It was Baltimore, the African braiding shops, how the people are talking. And
yeah,
talking about their status, you know. What to do, not to do.
Right. This is, it's so good. It's so good.
I could, and because I had my hair done in Philadelphia. So for me, it was in the braiding shop where I did my hair. Well, in the book.
Of course.
It was in that braiding shop in Philadelphia. I could visualize the whole thing. Like, yeah, it's a good feeling. Yeah, so that's how they feel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's how they feel.
Yeah.
It's good. So anyway, I hope there are more books. Oh,
yeah.
I actually forgot one book and it's not on this list. It was my favorite book last year. It's by Mwangala Lethbridge.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Still Standing. It's her true story, her story. But it's
okay.
Well written, it's witty, it's funny, and it's also sad. Because she used to like riding motorcycles.
Okay.
And she got in an accident in Zambia. She got hit by a car, and she lost her leg.
Ooh.
Yeah. So she sort of documents us, but it's just the way she writes it. I remember one day I was crying some pages and some pages I was laughing, you know. She says in Zambia we call motorbike Honda.
Yes.
Space is Kogit, you know, like.
Yeah, because those are the popular brands. Yes.
Yeah, and just her experience losing a limb. Then she went to the UK, did physical therapy, but coming back to Zambia, like being in a wheelchair, that whole experience, like going to restaurants, it makes you see like how do we deal with people who are disabled.
And
it was a
Zambia,
very emotional book.
Yeah. One of my goals, at least for this year or the coming years, is to read as many Zambian material as I can, as much Zambian material. Because it's a... Yeah, I've had enough of the American stuff. I mean, the American stuff is readily available, or the Western stuff is readily available. I'm trying to go out of my way to actually try to read material from my country. Yeah.
Absolutely agree. I agree, me too. That's why I'm doing, like, I do, like, Africa, you know, Zambia. Because Nigeria, they have a lot of books. They are on Audible.
Yeah. Nigeria
is so good. Even the stories are, like, wow, you know? And obviously, we're not there yet because the challenge is that they are not on Audible, and then time.
Yes.
The time to read the books is a bit of a challenge, but me too. That's where I'm trying to go. And I'm like, but how can these books be on Audible? So it's a little bit easier.
Yeah. Audio is much better because you can be doing something else in addition to listening to
You're cleaning, you're listening. How do I say thank you in Lenje?
I think the generic one would be Twagumba.
All right. Any final thoughts?
Yeah. Any final thoughts? So maybe I guess the one piece of advice that I like to give is that sometimes it is not the bicycle that you're riding, sometimes it is not how fast you're riding your bicycle. So I am using a bicycle metaphor, but you could really apply this to anything. It could be your car or your boat or whatever. But the whole point is that sometimes it is not how fast you're riding your bicycle, but what bike you're on. So it is no good spending too much time doing useless things. You want to make sure that the things that you're doing have value before you start expending your effort, energy, and time. So I would challenge everyone, before you do anything, don't just go all in and start wasting your resources and time. Think about what you're doing. Is it going to add value to you? Only then can you start applying those resources, time, energy, and effort?
Where can people find you?
Yeah, so the website would be my full name, joramutange.com. So if you just search for that, you'd find everything about me, really. My LinkedIn, my writings, and in every other thing, my podcast. It's all there.
Bye to our audience.
Yeah, well, very goodbye to everyone. And I'm very happy that you had me on the podcast.
Thank you very much. And until the next episode, it is goodbye.
Goodbye.